you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 39, and today I'm joined by the co-directors of the World in Conversation Project, Sam Richard and Laurie Mulvey. Their work explores the multifaceted relationship between people from different cultural and ancestral groups. More specifically, they use a Socratic method of dialogue to facilitate genuine, honest exchanges between people of differing perspectives, histories, and backgrounds. And they do this in ways that have a profound effect on those involved. So they join me today on the Digital Dialogue to talk about the transformative power of dialogue, and I'm really grateful for you two to coming on the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about what the World in Conversation Project is and a little bit of the history of it, and then maybe we could talk. I'd love to talk ultimately about the strategies you use with the students and how transformative dialogue happens in reality.
Mm-hmm. First, we should probably say that the World in Conversation Project is the brand new name of the Race Relations Project. And the name has changed simply because the dialogue has been expanding, and Race relations just does not encompass everything that we're doing. Right. So it sort of got confusing to be talking about race relations when we were talking about things like gender.
Right. I like the idea of conversation being in the title too, because it has this sort of sense of transformation.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And I think initially when we first started using the term Race Relations Project, even though we could talk about the fact that race is a construct and doesn't truly exist, we still felt at that time that race relations was this kind of a scary concept for people, and we wanted them to be a little uncomfortable when they came into it.
Right.
So we just stuck with that as the name. Now, you know, things I think have evolved over almost 10 years just specifically with the project that doesn't seem to be as necessary anymore beyond the fact that we just are expanding the dialogues that we're doing. Right.
Mm-hmm. So the Race Relations Project itself started 10 years, you said, or even longer?
I think we've been going for 8 years now, fully. I think this is our ninth year.
Okay.
Maybe our
Going into our ninth year.
Okay.
But it's just, you know, it expanded from the Social 19 class,
right,
the race relations class. So some of the work, has been happening for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Anyway, officially, yes, we're in our ninth year.
It initially started because some folks were interested in supporting conversations and dialogue and work on race here on campus, and approached me, approached the college to see if we would be interested in doing something. And I had been having the experience for a number of years prior to that, in which people would ask me to go out and give talks or do something around campus, and I just really didn't have the time. So I started sending students, facilitators or TAs in my stead, and they did a great job, leading a conversation about any number of things, immigration, affirmative action, inequality, or something. Mm-hmm. And so in addition, we had lots of TAs who were really skilled, and they would want to go further with this. And they'd say, well, what can we do? And I'd say, well, we don't really have anything because the new crop of folks are coming through.
Exactly.
Right.
And so we realized that, you know, we had all these great people that could go out and engage conversations across campus, and so it just took off.
So that was even before you had a whole facilitator training kind of program and all that. That was, they got their training in the Social 119 class or as TA or just work, or were there?
Well, sort of two parts. One, simply by being in dialogues, people are learning what the process is, what the protocol is. But then these people who would become teaching assistants would take a class with me concurrently. And so we would become a group and just sort of we'd be a laboratory, really, of group process. So they would read a manual that I wrote about group process, and then they would be in that group, and they would be facilitating groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be supervising them doing that. So that was how the training
evolved.
Yeah,
that went on for years.
Yeah.
I mean, it still goes on,
right,
but, you know, that was going on for years.
Yes, we continue to do that, but it's just a little more formal the way we do it now, just because there's so many more people.
So the first year of the Race Relations Project, we were hoping to do 100 groups throughout the year, 100 conversations, and we did 140. The second year, we said, hey, let's do 200, and we did 260, and then we were up to 500, and now we're up to almost 1,000 this past year.
Wow.
And next year, we'll do about, on the first year of the World in Conversation Project, my guess is we'll have about 1,200 to 1,400, wow, conversations.
So, and these are other institutions. I mean, whoever, who are the people that sort of call and say, "We need a conversation. We need this."
Well, the vast majority of those are here at Penn State, but also at the other campuses.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been doing for the past couple of years some work at East Stroudsburg University,
mm-hmm,
and a number of high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but we've kind of been limited, you know, in our abilities because we're so busy at University Park.
Right.
It's not been easy for us to get off.
We've also done, and we do regularly, it's different staff programs on, mm-hmm, campus. And they work well, but I think it works best when, at least at this level of facilitation, when people come together who don't know each other.
Right.
So it works really well with the student population. I mean, sometimes they come together and sign, mm, up with their friends, and
right,
it doesn't work as well. We try to send, right, them to different groups.
Interesting.
But the anonymous quality of it,
right,
I think, is better for the conversation.
So there's already, I mean, I would like to hear a little bit more about what prompts a unit in the university or from outside to give you a call, to look you up and find you. Is it a crisis situation, or is it just a general, somebody in the organization says, we really need to be practice having conversations about whether it be race or immigration or,
mm-hmm,
gender issues? I don't know.
Well, you should talk about the way the system works, where the vast majority of our conversations come from, and then we can talk about,
yeah, that. Yeah, we could say that. I mean, we contract out with colleges to do students in different colleges, right? So they pretty much every college in the university now, I mean, all but one,
mm-hmm,
we do all of the students, all the majors of that particular college. And staff programs, you know, happen. I mean, people, maybe it's the staff, they have a diversity committee or something,
right,
and they just want to do something and they hear about this and,
right,
they want to have conversation. They don't want to just have another presenter come in, but they actually want to talk.
Right.
And so people have heard something about the project through some channel, and then we send our people in. And it's kind of interesting, you know, to imagine having staff and administrators.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've done stuff for, you know, all the way up,
uh-huh,
the channels, and they're being, these are groups being facilitated by, you know, 20 to 22 year olds.
That's great.
And it works very well because, you know, people kind of lower their resistance,
right,
you know, they're not kind of their walls and so,
right,
on. And that's quite nice,
yeah,
actually, to see happen, because this only, you know, Socratic conversation only works when people are open and willing to say what's honestly on their mind.
Right.
But I don't think, I would say we rarely get, although the high school might be an exception, calls from people when there is something like a crisis.
Like a crisis. Oh, call in the...
Yeah, they don't... I don't
call in Sam
somehow
and Laura.
Bring
a SWAT team. Of,
yeah. We're definitely not seen in that way.
No.
Mostly it's, you know, a teacher is doing a unit on, you know, a,
right,
particular issue and like,
right,
oh, this would be nice. Or they,
right,
hear about it through their students, or a student actually just brings it up in the class. Maybe,
right,
we could do this. So,
well, it must be in some ways better, because when you're dealing with crisis situations that, you know, things are, tempers are high and tension is high, and it may not be always conducive to,
yeah,
you know, the kinds of conversations you're talking about.
Plus, our students, their focus is more encouraging people to talk, inviting them into a conversation, and they certainly deal with conflict, but that's not the focus of
right,
our work, and so I think they're probably more skilled at dealing with the let's get a conversation going as opposed to let's solve this terrible problem,
right,
that just occurred.
So I mean, now we're getting to some the real interesting element from my perspective is sort of what are the kinds of strategies. I've heard already, Laura, you talking about an element of discomfort, not focusing on the solution to something, but rather kind of having more open-ended discussion. I've heard also anonymity has a role to play in a positive respect,
mm-hmm,
here. So let's talk a little bit about sort of what goes on, how this happens.
Yeah, which should we start with?
Let's start with the discomfort. You know, it's not that we want people to
Sam goes right to the end.
Let's go right there. It's not, you know, and it's not, we certainly don't want people to be uncomfortable, because
right,
that doesn't make for a very genuine conversation.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we don't want them to be squirming in their seats.
Right.
We don't want
right,
to make them uncomfortable.
But we don't want them to have a script. And
right,
so the best conversations are those that are unscripted. And, you know, in this world in which these current generations of college students have been raised in this climate of political correctness,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, they've learned how to say the right things and how to speak about these issues without offending anybody.
Right.
And that takes the front seat when
right,
you engage in conversations about race or in particular. And so when they come in with their script and, you know, we ask a question and they've got the answer that's all kind of laid out,
mm-hmm,
and it's kind of, it becomes, you know, they're, Lori likes to say, you know, they're moving their lips and words are coming out, but nothing that means anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds great. But right. But so if we can get some discomfort in the room, then mm-hmm. they don't know what they really believe.
So you want discomfort, but not defensiveness.
That's right.
Right? And you, what about yours?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I think when I was talking about the race relations word, I think yeah. I wanted people to know that they were coming to talk about something that was going to be hot.
Right.
And I didn't. So I just wanted that to be on their minds. But once they get into the room, we really work for the opposite.
Right.
We do a lot of things about building rapport and, you know, encouraging people to say things that are difficult and awkward. And
so whatever. How do you do that? So there's a trust building dimension to this mm-hmm. at first. And maybe that's why the anonymity can help, because nobody knows what to expect in some
right,
ways.
Right, right. And no one has to, well, we all do it naturally, but to a great degree, you don't have to protect certain things in relationship to people that are friends or colleagues and whatever. We don't have to protect information. You can just be in the room, say what you say, actually dig into what you think and feel that you may not even know, so you don't have to live in the middle of that persona that you've created
mm-hmm.
when you're with people who you don't know, because mm-hmm. they don't know who you are, and so you're more free to explore
yeah.
what's in you. And that's really what we're trying to do, is get beyond the script that people believe that mm-hmm. they believe.
Right.
So it's not people are not necessarily just censoring themselves. I mean, that happens, but they're also believing that they believe what they've been taught to say. And that's what we're trying to get beneath, is get to those moments that are live where someone says, oh, yeah, when, you know, Hispanic person would drive down the street in my neighborhood, we would notice and we would react this way. Oh, really? So uh-huh. let's talk about that, because we were just talking about how you don't see race or culture and how everybody's the same and whatever, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're telling us a story that's suggesting something else that goes on. Like, now we've gotten somewhere. Not gotten somewhere like, aha,
We're not picking out racism.
Yeah, we're not looking.
There's no way in which we're doing
it. All we're trying to do is to bring the sort of subconscious material to the surface so that we can look at it. Because
mm-hmm.
we all have subconscious material, and not mm-hmm. just about these topics that we're talking about. So we're really just trying to build rapport enough that people can start to freely talk and freely add to the stories that are being told, so that they can then see something that they haven't said
before.
So
how does that happen concretely? I mean, so somebody takes a risk and says something real, or says...
Sometimes someone...
Yeah, I get uncomfortable.
It's just like that.
Uh-huh.
Someone in the room is like, you know what? I'm just going to say, this is how I feel. Or I have this roommate, and this was my experience when they walked into the room. Or some that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it tends to be more likely that it happens because we're now talking about friendship. How do you develop friendships at college?
Uh-huh.
And then we start talking about, well, who did you go toward? What does your friendship group look like? That's interesting. So you're Jewish and all your friends tend to be Jewish. And how did that happen? And then as we're telling those stories and people are supporting how they've made their friends, somebody tells a story, contradictions come up, the Socratic method. All this, as we start asking,
mm-hmm.
you know, what is the truth? Truth starts to take on many different dimensions.
So you start out with sort of, you know, who are you?
Yeah.
Kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. It's things that are kind of getting to know each other. I mean, it can start out. But you don't have a script of how it will start out, right?
Fundamentally, I mean, the most important way in which it starts out is we select facilitators who are genuinely curious about other people.
Uh-huh.
So they don't want to teach. They don't want to preach. They don't want to do the kind of social... They don't get into working with us because they want to... walk down the road of social justice, which
mm-hmm.
is important, mind you,
right?
But that's not what
right.
they're doing.
I think that's a dimension of it, but it's not. But they're coming at it from a very different angle.
Well, I mean, in that sense, there's a Socratic dimension to this sort of strong anti-dogmatistic perspective.
Right.
It's not about preaching a concrete positive position. It's about trying to uncover some things, and also this idea of recognizing one's own beliefs and one's own commitments and one's own limitations that then frees.
Right, because in a certain context, we would say the word social justice and everyone would know what we're talking about, and we would just proceed doing something about it. Here, with this work, we would say, well, what is social justice? And what is it to you? And what is it to you? And how do you know? And how did you get that idea? And then
these are all questions.
Right, you know, sure.
And then we leave the room and we don't even know what social justice is anymore.
Right.
But yet we've now thought, and we're getting deep.
Well, that, I'm laughing because, you know, the aporetic dialogues, these early Socratic dialogues are all aporetic, which means we don't, you know, there's never the answer, what is piety, what is the good, what is the just? And that, you know, has been frustrating philosophers for many generations. Yeah. But to me, it's like, well, yeah, but haven't we been led to a different place? Now, we don't have the I can pull it out of my pocket definition and read it and not think about it anymore, but we are at a different place.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Listen, one time, remember that conversation that you witnessed that day? These students were sort of going around the room and talking about just racial injustice and how wrong it was. And one of our facilitators, who's from Philly, mm-hmm. and he really spent most of his time here at Penn State with kind of very much an Afrocentric view, just mm-hmm. said, look, what if Black people really are inferior to other people?
Now, stop for a second. Is this person Black
this
or white?
This guy's Black.
Okay.
So he's saying, what if they really are inferior? Mm-hmm. And people say, well, you know, I don't, they kept going. No, he said, no. This isn't a challenge to you. I really want us to talk about what that would mean if mm-hmm. that's really true. Let's explore it. They had nothing to even grab onto because
they had no defenses.
They had no defenses.
No script.
Yeah, mm. so then they had an honest and a mm-hmm. real conversation mm-hmm. because, you know, hey, so let's talk about this thing that we're not even allowed to bring up in any way.
Right.
And now we're seeing this with gender dialogues. You know, everybody on race, everyone knows exactly what to say and when to say it.
Right.
But when you start talking about gender, there's no script.
Right.
You know, we really don't follow script.
Except that what we've learned, or what I've learned this semester listening to it, mm-hmm. listening to those dialogues, was that the men across the board will say, no means no, no means no, no means no. And uh-huh. and yet, we had conversations uh-huh. where that were very edgy in terms of, you know, at least one of the men in the room sharing that he may have actually crossed the line, and yet he was saying no means no.
Uh-huh. Right,
So it's sort of the same, like, you know, the same script where we know what's right and we believe it. This is the thing I really think is important to understand, is that we believe that we think it until we start to examine how we live, how we feel, what we move away from, what we move toward. Right. And that's what we're just trying to do.
But, I mean, there is a role. Is there not a role for these kinds of bumper sticker things like no means no and other kinds of things?
Absolutely.
When we're not in the conversation mode and trying to really peel these things away, where there's an important aspect of that says, look, you know, broadly speaking, if a lot of people are saying no means no, and not only just saying it, but actually thinking about it and living by it, that is better than not saying it, right?
That's right. So at 2 a.m,
right.
that
Hopefully,
might be a voice that just comes into your head. Like, right. Hang on a minute.
It might be, but it reminds me of like sort of the beginning of the semesters when, you know, maybe typically we'll do things asking students to talk about, you know, how they want the conversations to go throughout the semester and how they want to participate, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they talk about honesty and authenticity and sincerity, integrity, all those lovely mm-hmm. things that we all believe in until you get to a moment that's emotional.
Right.
And then that stuff is, for all of us, you know, very quickly after.
So, I mean, so then what are you losing? I mean, it seems to me that the freedom that you gain when you bring people in, people who don't know each other, into a room together, and you take advantage of the fact that they don't know each other, that they don't need to front for their friends or live with the consequences of what they say in right. their real life in terms of, mm-hmm. oh, man, you said that. I'm never going to forget. I'm your friend or your wife. I'm never going to forget that you said this context. But there's a freedom there. There is mm-hmm. something liberating and important about that. But that's not where people live their lives, first of all. That's the first point. And
right.
the second point is that there's still a dynamic, as you said, the person who was bringing up the what if African Americans are inferior, really, was an African American. So people are coming embodied into the room anyway,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of ways in which that plays itself out, however much you kind of bracket. I mean, there's a little bit of bracketing going on with the anonymity
right.
side.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could take the two things. One is the sort of the embodiment in the room, and then what about the other question of, okay, we had this great conversation, but now I'm living my real life and I'm still, like, maybe I might remember what happened in there, but I'm not saying the hard things to the people who I love and I care about and I need to communicate with.
I think that it's, what's important in this kind of a context is hearing oneself. that for the first time, and we love when it's for the first time, when you can see that.
And it often is.
When you see the light bulb go off, you know, and something like, I never thought about that before. I've never said that before. Right. I never heard that before. For me, the articulation of that to oneself is just an important first step to understanding where you position yourself in the world, maybe in contrast to how you thought you did. You know, for me, that's what it is. It's not.
So for you, Laurie, as a director of this program and as a sometimes facilitator, I'm thinking, the reason why I'm wondering is because I'm thinking about the Socratic dialogues, and I'm thinking, you know, Socrates didn't have many of the, I'm trying to think of a moment where somebody is transformed in that way, really does recognize. Usually they just, they don't get it. They don't see it. They and so what keeps a guy like that going? I mean, I can see what keeps you going when you've got these moments, even however frustrating it might be otherwise. But, and this sort of what I call the Socrates' erotic orientation toward wisdom, toward truth, towards goodness, meaning that he continues to be drawn to it, continues to try to move toward it, however frustrating and however full of failure his conversations were. Now, I think he's doing things in somewhat of a different way, but I mean, there are those moments that keep you going.
Yes,
that nourish you.
They're
absolutely
magical.
Yeah.
But, you know, and for us, I have to say that they happen regularly in groups, that we hear people say, I didn't realize I thought that. And I've never been asked that question before. So here, let me try to come up with an answer. And then they, you know, they're really working to get somewhere. And you know, we base our entire model is based on this kind of these theories of decision making and personal change that are kind of rooted in the idea that most of us don't change our thinking as a result of long and detailed and kind of drawn out, you know, reflection on a particular problem or issue. But in fact, it happens in an instant. You know, it's one conversation. And, you know, when you get to be our age and we think back over the past 25 years, I think of those half dozen conversations that really shaped my life. And I can remember exactly where I was and what was going on and who said what and what I said. And what we found in doing focus group research on the project, and you know, we were, several years ago, I tell this story that we were really ready to close up shop. You know, it was so much work. It was really brutal. But someone was doing focus group research, and the findings were so positive in that, you know, what happened was this was a time when people would do the project, say, 2, 3, and sometimes 4 times because of just the way the classes were lined up. Now that doesn't happen. But we would, every night, we'd pull the people out who had done the project before, and sometimes it was 3 months earlier and sometimes it was 2 years earlier. And she would sit them down and say, you know, what do you remember and what happened? And the you know, it was pretty astounding, actually, how much they were able to remember. And so,
but and more so, it was that they did talk to people. It wasn't that it just stayed in the room. You know, they would go home. They would be on the phone, you know, calling their mom and asking a question or talking to the boyfriend or girlfriend or whomever. But there or a conversation with a roommate. But that there was the spreading of the conversation that they were thinking. And that's, I mean, that's the other piece, is we also are just asking people to think about what's there and, you know, kind of then dip into the complexities of all of this, not just, you know, the rote aspect of it. So there is more, I think, than just it happens in this moment and it stays enclosed in the individual.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah. Another interesting piece is that the large number of people that evaluate the program is worthwhile, and one would think that a very few people would, because, you know, they're out having these conversations and discussion. I mean, this is what college is about, right? You sit in the coffee shops or you sit up in your dorm room till 2 or 3 in the morning. Debating these kinds of issues, but in fact, people aren't talking about it.
Yeah,
and so it's actually rather disconcerting that these conversations are evaluated so positively. So
I mean, you know, when in your normal student everyday life, your conversations with your friends are so fraught with, I imagine, with all the social, cultural sort of things that are at play, whether you look a certain way or sound a certain way or are a certain way. And even with your close friends, I mean, you need to practice, you know, what it means to speak honestly and to, so what are the sorts of excellences or virtues or habits that facilitate those kinds of honest conversations with one another.
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually thinking, I thought you were going in a different direction, but I think the answer applies. because what I see happening with the facilitators themselves as they are live their lives is they just start listening to people. I mean, and therefore asking questions based on the fact that they just heard what their roommate said or what their friend said or whomever. And that's fundamental to the work, is really taking the time to say, oh, wait a minute, you didn't finish your sentence. Can you finish your sentence? Because I'm listening, and I realize you didn't finish your sentence, and I want to hear the rest of it. And then, now that you said that, I have this question. But it's just this active listening that evolves. I mean, so that's what allows the conversations to move forward. And that's what we hear from our facilitators is happening all the time. Suddenly, they're in the middle of all these conversations. What do they call it? Like, I facilitated my friend. Their friends will say, stop facilitating me. Which is really just a naturally active kind of listening that's occurring. You know?
Yeah, and these folks, their lives are transformed.
That's what I mean, partly going to answer.
In some ways, the entire project is about the facilitators.
It is.
Right.
And
they've gone on. You know what I mean? People graduating, going on into, you know, private business or whatever, and people find out that they have these skills, and they're just, you know, wonderful things are happening to them. So, but it is different. Something to go back a few minutes. But people bring their own bodies and their own cultures and their own histories into the room. And you know, this work is because, you know, Penn State is disproportionately white. I mean, Pennsylvania is. So you know, we're about 84% white here among the undergrad population on campus. And a lot of white students have not had a good deal of experience with students of color, people of color. Right. And so a lot of times these groups become almost confessionals. You know, it's like white people have to kind of put out, I don't know if confessionals is the right word, but white people spend a fair amount of time putting out into the room the all the negative stuff they see in their family and friends and so on. And it's can be very burdensome for our facilitators of color.
Yeah, we see it. We really have really tuned into the much quicker burnout for students of color. In particular, we think African American women. That it's just a lot.
So they take it on. They don't let it just be in the room the dynamic?
I think they do. I mean, we choose people that do a good job of listening and putting it in, you know, in a context that they can manage it. But, you know, fundamentally, they're hearing stuff sort of against their culture on a regular basis. Right. And they're also having to do some kind of gymnastics to present themselves in the room in a way that white people can hear. So very different than the white facilitator who is just with their tribe, you know, number one. And then isn't maybe, you know, you're feeling bad about, oh, man, this is another story about a white person being on some level ignorant. Okay, but just not, it's the burden of that is not like the burden it is for people of color.
And there's a gender dimension here too, that you're saying that African American women or women of color have a more difficult time.
Yeah, and I don't know if, you know, there's a sensitivity that's there that's just hard for them to, after a while, manage it.
And mind you, you know, we're careful about who we select, right? So we're selecting people who have, you know, really have an orientation toward conversation, but it gets heavy. And specifically African American women, because lots of our facilitators of color are not black, and so, you know, it's not as challenging for them in the same way. Because white people, and again, this isn't just about white people, because it's very important. People of color get challenged in these rooms. This is not about white people. This is about, from the race conversation anyway, it's about race relations. And so we you know, students of color, people of color don't just get to walk in and say whatever they want. It's certainly not about white bashing in any way. But
it's a little more, the dynamics are a little difficult when there's, you know, eight people in the room who are white and then two people who aren't. And so it's a little, the challenges are not necessarily meted out the same unless it's a very mixed group.
And so when I mean, depending on what you're facilitating, what topic, right? Are you thinking about the composition, the composition of the room and the composition of the facilitator, who the facilitator is? I mean, all of those variables are going to have a very different dynamic that's going to have to be dealt with, and I mean, maybe different with different strategies.
Sometimes we just, depending on, like, often Each night we have five groups happening at one time. So when people are coming in the room, we can filter them into different rooms. Okay. So sometimes
you want a balance of races, a balance of depending on what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we will wind up having just all white people in a room and two white facilitators. So that conversation has a very particular kind of structure because now it's white people talking to white people about being white. And then that conversation evolves in a particular way. So, but it's difficult because a lot of what we have is a mostly white person group with a couple of people of color. And that balance just doesn't lend to the kind of equal challenges on both sides. Now, all the work we do with the facilitators is always balanced between, not balanced between cultures, but half students of color and half white students. So everybody's...
do you facilitate for them and then have them... So there's a lot of that conversation they have to have.
Yeah.
And you try to have that more balanced.
This is with the TAs, the first level of facilitators. Half of the positions are for white students and half are for students of color.
Uh-huh.
So that we always have mixed pairs when they come into a group. So we have to do it that way, or we choose to do it that way. And I think it works well. But then in those training groups that happen, on a weekly basis, they're always having conversations that are fully mixed. And so the challenges then are meted out much more, quote unquote, equally among different cultural groups. So it doesn't just become, we really can't go there because we don't have enough students representing that culture to really, say much about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, which we run into all the time in the it's now World in Conversation groups across campus.
Right.
So we're always managing those dynamics and who are the facilitators in the room, and if black male is in the room, how does that affect, as a facilitator, how's that affecting how the group goes? And then,
it does.
And then we have, we learned this semester with one of the black males that we work with. He worked with me, co-facilitated with me on these Middle East groups, so West meets Middle East, and what struck him the most was how he didn't have to be the black guy in the room. And so, he realized for himself, I go in these other groups and I'm doing all kinds of gymnastics to try to make everybody be okay with the black guy in the room in these mostly white groups.
But in the Middle East groups, he was able to truly facilitate.
Not have to put some kind of...
that's the thing. It's interesting because that idea of as if to truly facilitate, you have to be disembodied in a kind of way, or you you have to do active things to undermine your embodiment or to make it okay, which makes for a lot more work, I think, probably for the African American facilitators or the facilitators of color, depending on the context. So there's part of me that says, okay, but wait, and maybe this is part of what gets thematized in the discussion. I don't know if the facilitator says, look, I'm spending a lot of time here trying to, undermine the fact that you're talking to me in a certain way because I'm black or whatever. I mean, so that gets you just start.
Would come up.
Right.
It comes up when the facilitators are totally on their game. There's times if they're in a conversation in the observation room where somebody's supervising them and that's not happening, we can definitely say to them, because we're speaking to them remotely, hey, talk about this. Talk about the fact of who you are.
That's when you're training them, not in the conversation.
But in every night, one of our conversations is observed in that kind of context. So,
we have a monitor system that people wear an earbud.
Oh.
So we can just feed them questions, and they can then facilitate without having to pause, but they are getting direction from supervisors.
I think I need something like that in my classroom. I would love to have somebody address this issue.
Right.
The voice of conscience coming in at me, hold you accountable. Actually, Socrates does talk about this voice. Of course, this voice only tells him not to do certain things. But anyway, still, that wouldn't be bad.
It's helpful.
Go ahead.
But it's just to finish. So sometimes we can really capture it in those moments when a facilitator has support. But most of the times we're just encouraging them to basically do whatever's in the room. That's what we're always focusing on, what's in the room. Mm-hmm. And if what's in the room is that people are reacting to you, then maybe, and ideally the co-facilitator kind of takes on that role and says, hey, how come you're reacting to so-and-so in this way?
Name it.
Talk whatever
about
it is. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're pretty fearless.
They're
going to
I'm thinking we've got this attentive listening excellence, a certain kind of courage, right? Mm-hmm. A kind of courage mm-hmm. that is able to not only recognize the dynamics, but also
act on it,
talk about it, thematize it mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. context of that. I mean, that's a huge... to be able to do that, I know that in my own family, in my own relationships, to be able to say, okay, look, I'm feeling this way.
Right.
What is making me now? Can I talk about that?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's happening?
Or why
right
you're
now.
Responding that? What's that look about? Or what's that? That is tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really tough. And imagine that we're starting each year with, you know, over 1,000, I mean, something like 1,400 possible facilitators.
Right.
And out of the 1,400, we're trying to just find 20
right.
who can really do this.
Right.
And it's not easy.
And also,
them.
When someone sees what's happening in the room and they're willing to go after what's happening in the room, there's a real nuance in being able to do it non-judgmentally with open questions mm-hmm. where you're, you know, it's like, I noticed that you had that particular or it
yeah.
looked like you had a reaction. Could we talk about that? As a, you know, sometimes it gets delivered in a way that seems very condescending.
Yeah.
Or anyway, so even just the nuance
right.
with how to,
right.
to approach that.
Right, because people who walk in the door assume that we're looking for racists. So anything you say
right.
as a facilitator is going to be filtered through that idea.
Right.
So it's like, oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Now, here's the moment
right.
when you're going to call me out.
Back up in the chair.
Right.
Just to go, you know, we did these alcohol dialogues this past semester, and we're going to be doing more this coming year.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting students to talk openly about their drinking culture. And what was interesting is that the non-drinkers in the room, you could talk about that. I mean, I want to bring it up, but the non-drinkers in the room kind of took the role of almost people of color.
Uh-huh.
The drinkers were the majority,
right.
and the non-drinkers are the ones who were always kind of on the outs, and
uh-huh.
you know, people were looking in a certain way, and so the dynamics are always there.
Yeah, I mean, some of our students of color who were obviously engaged in these conversations were saying, wow, I felt like what white people must have felt like in that conversation because, you know, I'm in the drinking crowd, you know. So
right.
it's always really interesting to see what happens, you know, the majority-minority dynamic in any group, really.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we had to have two facilitators. So we'd want one who drinks and one who doesn't drink to
uh-huh.
go in there because the non-drinkers in the room have got to really have the support there. So, like, if we have two participants in the room who are of color and we need a facilitator of color. I mean, you just got to see that bond. Two white facilitators aren't going to do
right.
the same thing. So, and those are interesting conversations. Talk about Socratic, sort of the Socratic method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're going to talk about drinking in a very, very new way.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the, I don't even know what the questions are that I could even possibly put on the table, let alone select those out to bring
mm-hmm.
into the room. So
right.
that's when it gets really exciting.
Yeah.
And that those conversations actually are really exciting to me right now because it's not – because they're students talking to each other and
right.
it's not someone telling them how they should think or how they should
right.
act, but literally, like, let's talk to each other about
right.
what our lives are like in relationship to drinking. And so, you know, so it's really pure conversation at that level because no one knows what the conversation is going to be. It's fascinating,
yeah.
and I think very healthy.
Yeah,
like it's been amazing to listen to them. I mean, I have been able to observe all of those this semester, so I've gotten an education myself.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple of things that are striking me now. So one is, I mean, in a certain way, the ideal would be for everyone to get some of the skills and some of the virtues of a good facilitator. But there's the thing, and this goes back to my embodiment question. There's still, and the judgmental. So is there a difference between being, there must be a difference between being judgmental and having a ground and a position and right? So what you're asking the facilitators to do is to sort of bracket some of their judgmental or
mm-hmm.
some of their positions, right?
Yeah.
And to allow the conversation to go in a certain kind of way. But I worry about, I mean, maybe this is too philosophical a worry, but this is kind of this notion that there's this abstract subject that's absolutely free and not and unencumbered by embodiment, and that's the kind of subject that has to facilitate these kinds of things. That, in fact,
Person as subject.
Yeah, person as subject. I was thinking philosophically as subject, but also now person as subject, that that there's something about the neutrality, the subjective neutrality, that now all things are possible. And I want my sort of reaction to that is, well, wait a minute, we're never like that. And so you're spending a lot of time with your facilitators to say, you know, you need to deal with that stuff so that you can be this kind of neutral, safe, fair, I don't know.
Okay, I'm so glad you asked it.
Yeah.
I think what we're trying to do, what we are trying to do is create a neutral environment,
mm-hmm.
but we're not trying to create neutral people, per se.
Right.
I mean, this is actually the most difficult aspect of facilitating. This is where you get to the art of facilitation, where you actually become yourself. You're allowing yourself to be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, when we start out with facilitators, we were really asking them to not use their personal stories in the conversations or whatever, because we know that they're not ready yet skill-wise to be able to use them without oppressing people with their stories.
Because they have their own, they're coming with their own habits, their own ways of responding.
Right, and so that's one of those temporary things that, you know, you learn in math class. I say that, you know, you can't subtract a larger number from a smaller number. At first, you have to believe that.
Right.
This is what this is like. First, you have to believe that you can't put yourself in the room. Then, as you move on, you're like, you have to be in the room. You are in the room.
Right.
And then we really try to work with how can you be in the room? So you have a reaction. How do you put that reaction into the room in a way that facilitates the conversation instead of shuts down the conversation?
Right.
How can you use yourself and your history and your experiences to expand the conversation? Right. That's really what we're moving toward. And we're not choosing facilitators who all act the same, look the same, have the same style. We really want people to have their own styles, their own way of being animated in the room, because people react to different kinds of people. So we know the diversity of that is what we're looking for. So we're really not looking for those people who have no subjectivity.
Right.
It's really have it, but initially you don't know how to use it yet.
Right.
But by the time people are on the World in Conversation project, the campus-wide project, we are fundamentally encouraging them to find their voice and to figure out how to use their stories. And I know for myself as a facilitator, I always felt like I was going in the wrong direction when I used me. And then I've realized this is the only thing I have. I've got
to
use myself.
And you have to be willing. I mean, I think facilitators have to be willing to themselves be transformed by that that conversation.
Absolutely.
If it's going to be a genuine.
Absolutely. Yeah, and if you don't take risks, no one else is taking risks. Right. And then it's how can this be a live situation when no one's doing it.
Very stale.
So, yeah, that's key. I'm so glad you asked that.
We had a training moment last semester when we were talking about calling people out in a group who aren't being honest. And so this one person was asking me, you know, could I have called this person out in this situation? And I said, no. You know, so-and-so could call him out because they would know how to do it. And in our three other facilitators in the room, they could call him out.
But
the rest of you, you're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
You're not ready. You don't know how to do it in a way that will really elicit a positive response. And so, and I think that's very much what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just that there's a process that we're taking people through. And it's a quick one. They're going, semester by semester. Yeah.
They're working hard, man. These folks are doing 3 to 4 groups a week all semester long.
So could this be translated into the classroom? I mean, can teachers be facilitators in this kind of way? I mean, I know in your big class, Sam, you there's a certain kind of facilitation that you do, but you are – it's a totally saturated by a performance element that has to be there in front of this huge. You have to do it in a certain way. I'm wondering. We faculty teachers are not really trained to think about our own what we're bringing in this. It's thinking about this classroom as a place of trust building and of trying to, I mean, I think some people do it. Some people can do it. But how does that, I mean, of course, then the power dynamic that's operating in all classes is something that you have to consider. It adds another.
Yeah. I want to respond to that directly just from a personal level, because I found myself, I always thought through my process of moving through the university, I was drawn to the teaching realm, and I thought, you know, okay, teacher, that's natural for me.
Right.
But I found that whenever I was in the room, and especially standing in front of the room, every time I said something, I would look around the room and I would see all these faces that had all of these potentially alternative realities, alternative views of what I was saying. And I, standing, for me to stand up in front of the room and talk at people, mm-hmm. for me it was talking at people and share information, was impossible. Like, I only came to this facilitation realm because that was the really the only way I could be in the classroom, was to say something mm-hmm. and then say, well, what do you think about that? Well, what's your experience of that? Is that true for you? Mm-hmm. So I couldn't be that person who delivered information because I realized that there was so much more resource in the room. Of course, I'm in mm-hmm. social sciences. It's a little different than if mm-hmm. I was teaching about chemistry or math or something. But I know that for me, it's difficult to do the standing in front of the classroom, holding on to the power kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I know that I know the two can come together. But I feel like I personally am more on the extreme of, I see too much happening in the room to be able to just hold the reins by myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that that's very different than a lot of people in the room who feel more comfortable sharing information and feel that that's what they can mm-hmm. really offer to the classroom. Well, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's related to some of the stuff we were talking about yesterday at the mm-hmm. at Learning Design Summer Camp. And one of the things I'm thinking a lot about is what I'm trying to call cooperative education, in which students are empowered to take some ownership and are given some authority in the classroom to determine the direction of the discussion and even some maybe the content of the course. There's different levels of which that's possible.
Right.
But the common denominator is, from my perspective, is that we are, when we're in the classroom, when we're engaged in this learning endeavor, there's a community that's growing, that's being cultivated, and it can be cultivated in this. It can be destroyed, I think, by a very top down kind of control, traditional kind of controlling mechanism, or it can be nourished, and the nourishing of it is tough. Mm-hmm. Because it takes a lot of trust in your students' ability to respond and your mm-hmm. own ability to relinquish some control and mm-hmm. but to maybe regain it in other ways and hope that they'll come back at you and respond to you in a way where you could sort of get what you think is important to get to them.
But you can what I find in these smaller group conversations and in my teaching is that I can have more control if I give up control mm-hmm. if I give it up. And so when we tell that to our facilitators, look, be present in the room, yeah. be aware of everything that's happening, put yourself out there, and get them talking to one another. Yeah. Now, you're the middle of it, but nobody ever sees that. And so you have total control over what's going on, and yet you're invisible. And I think instructors could do that more in our, mm-hmm. In our classrooms. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like we're either in it or we're out of it.
But see, this is just going back to my own being invisible, like that, as if that were the. I know you don't mean that that's the ideal, that the facilitator becomes invisible. The point is that the facilitator is who she or he is, really, genuinely, in the room, and that room has the atmosphere in which the real conversations, mm-hmm. where you can really say who you are.
Well, it's like, I watch Lori facilitate, who's a master facilitator, and she says very little. And, the things are happening all over the room, and sometimes it's body language, sometimes it's just moving her eyebrows, sometimes it's just looking at somebody across the room at the right moment.
Uh-huh.
It's just knowing that if I ask this person to respond to that other person, those two in particular, I just know something's going to go. And it's like she just knows it.
Uh-huh.
And I think for us as instructors,
yeah.
and that, I think that's what I mean by invisible. It's like the yeah. magician wielding the power.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, I can make this happen here.
Yeah.
But we don't tap into that energy.
But see, I guess what I'm worried about in that context is I don't want to feel. I mean, I feel like being the magician wielding the power is still too authoritarian in a different kind. It's a manipulation kind of way.
I wouldn't say it that way. This is the difference between Sam and I. Okay. Sam is, who Sam is as the lecturer. As a facilitator, I feel like I'm creating the possibility for people to talk to each other.
Right.
And somehow having a person or two facilitators holding the space
right.
and just managing it, being yeah. while everyone else is lost in the conversation, there's someone that's watching the conversation.
Right.
Even though I'm still me, my job in that moment is to watch it and
right.
to say, oh, wait, we forgot about this person over here, or that perspective got lost. Let's bring that perspective in. So I'm not wielding the power. In fact, I'm always asking myself, oh, wait a minute, I wanted to go there. Well, maybe the group doesn't want to go there right now, so let me hold that here. If something keeps telling me to go there, I will go there. But I don't know where we're going. Right. So I'm not wielding any power other than to try to hold this group to what its mission is, which is to talk to one another in as candid a way as they can, because I think that's important. Right. And then that's it. That's what I'm trying to do. So I'm not.
I mean, I think there's also a dimension of the if you're thinking about the 720 social 119 kind of clash, sure. there has to be some smoke and mirrors involved.
Exactly.
I mean, otherwise, it's not, you know. So absolutely. I mean, I don't know that that's the context in which we're talking about. Obviously, we're talking about in a class like I teach, with lower number of students. I think there can be some more of that. But, you know, I'm thinking about this also in terms of this podcast and being the person to facilitate this podcast and having this as number 39 or whatever, and constantly thinking about trying to get better at listening, trying to get better at, like, allowing the silence and the rhythm of the conversation to be what it is, even though I know I'm kind of responsible for making sure we, you know, I don't know what. I mean, happily, it's a podcast, so you doesn't have to, like, we don't have to have a commercial break or,
Right.
And you have different people you're speaking with every week, and they all have sort of a different orientation. But if it were the same, if you were going to do six of these with us, by the third one, you'd really have a rhythm now.
Yeah.
And I think that's more akin to the classroom,
right?
You know, but
that's true. And how does that? And it's going to be different for every class too. I mean, every class has its personality and its sort of what happens, what happens to it. And I think that's not easy for us as faculty to allow that openness, because you're thinking, well, I got all this material to cover, I have to be prepared with all these, you know, point A, B, C, and D, and, you know, and also from the student side, I mean, I don't think students often are ready for the kind of responsibility that comes with, okay, you want some control over the class, where are we going?
That's right.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's definitely. Yeah, it takes a while to get the students to understand, although I think now we've created a culture within the work that we're doing, but even still, to understand that, no, we really want to know what you think. Like, that's it.
Right.
This is nothing bigger than that. But it definitely takes, you know, a process that we have to engage in. But I think there's also an underlying belief in information that I think gets in the way, I think, as faculty of engaging more with
you
the
students.
You
mean knowledge as information as knowledge? Is that what you mean? Like, this information must be conveyed or the class is a waste.
Or as if there are, I mean, again, I'm in the social sciences, so maybe it is a little different, but still that there are facts.
Yeah.
And I have a really broad sense of what is a fact, especially, you know, as we submit these facts to Socratic dialogue, for example. Suddenly we don't even know what the edges are of them anymore. You know, like the social justice. After a while, what is this thing we're talking about? And I think if more folks just happen to, like, look at information in that way, whether it's good or bad is not the point, they would then engage differently with the information. I personally just don't see a lot of facts, and so it's hard for me to just be like, okay, these are the facts you need to know.
I think in a certain way, if we're not going to caricature the sciences, the best scientists are the ones who question those facts and ask about how we know what we know, or test them in ways, or you know. So I think all the things that I try to do in my philosophy class about, you know, getting people to ask questions and things like that are, we do it with all these great ideas, fun thing, you know, texts and all that. But I mean, I think it's very translatable into science and all kinds of different areas,
right? Right, absolutely.
So, well, I want to thank you both for coming on to the Digital Dialogue, and I hope we can do it again at some point.
Yeah, yeah,
thanks for having
great.
Us. Yeah,
we'll
it's really
come
helpful.
Back.
Great.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.